Welcome, I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Happy May Day to everyone. We will begin this morning with Baltimore. On April 19th, Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old African-American man, died from severe spinal injuries while in police custody, and his death set off large protests in Baltimore. As the media's attention stayed on the isolated pockets of violence, however, thousands of people were marching peacefully through the city demanding justice for Freddie Gray and organizing volunteers to clean up their neighborhood. We're going to be talking about the media coverage of the unrest in Baltimore and bringing you up to date on today's developments, big developments. We're joined by Lawrence Lanahan, former senior producer at Baltimore's NPR member station WYPR. There he launched The Lines Between Us, a year-long examination of regional inequality that won the 2014 Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Award. Lawrence Lanahan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And then 40 miles away from Baltimore in Washington this week, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe met with President Obama and hailed a new chapter in Japan's, quote, alliance of hope with the United States. But at the same time, hundreds of Koreans, Chinese, and Okinawans were protesting on Capitol Hill, demanding an apology from Prime Minister Abe for Japan's wartime crimes, including the use of Korean women as sex slaves by Japan's army during World War II. To discuss the media coverage of Prime Minister Abe's week-long visit to the United States, we're joined by Tim Shorrock. He's a national security correspondent at The Nation magazine and the author of the book Spies for Hire: The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Tim Shorrock, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to hear you again, Tim. We're old colleagues, I should say, and we always do start the Your Call Media Roundtable every week. Try to start on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter or a news organization that did a good job this week. So, Tim, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you admired as a journalist?
Well, I have to say, in terms of the U.S.-Japan coverage, I can't say much about very good about the U.S. media coverage of it, but the Japanese newspaper Asahi and a Korean newspaper called Hankyore did excellent coverage of Abe and the politics surrounding his visit here. Some other stories that I picked up that were excellent. I've got two stories that I saw in BuzzFeed were excellent this week. One was by Gregory Johnson, who's been covering national security for them and Yemen for them for a while. He wrote a very long profile of CIA Director John Brennan, which was long in coming, and I know he'd been working on this piece for months, but it's an example of the kind of long-form journalism you can find online, and particularly in BuzzFeed now, and it was a really, really good piece, and I highly recommend it to anyone really wanting to know, you know, in depth about John Brennan and where he came from and his past in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and so on. And also there was a very good, it'd be interesting to hear what Lawrence has to say about the Baltimore coverage, but I also saw there was a guy named Joel Anderson, also writing for BuzzFeed, who wrote a really good piece that to me stood out on Monday, or I guess it was he reported it on Tuesday. It stood out to me because he really went out and talked to people in the streets and, you know, got, you know, a full sense of what it was like out there and what people were really feeling, and I thought that was just excellent. And there was a very good story also on the intelligence war front by a guy named Adam Entus, who writes for the Wall Street Journal. This was a day or so after President Obama apologized for a drone that killed two American hostages held by al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And this Wall Street Journal story revealed that actually the rules and guidelines for drone strikes in Pakistan have been much looser than elsewhere. And that was a very important story to get out because clearly there have been massive numbers of civilian casualties, and the only reason it came to our attention recently was because of these two Americans. So those are the stories I would name.
Thank you, Tim. That's Tim Shorrock, national security correspondent with The Nation magazine. And, of course, we'll be providing links to those stories at yourcallradio.org. And Lawrence Lanahan, tell us, what did you see of the coverage this week that was impressive to you?
Well, I'm glad Tim had all of that, because I don't know what's going on in the rest of the world more than 5 miles outside of Baltimore.
Yeah.
The one I liked was one from the Baltimore Sun here. Mark Puente and Doug Donovan are their investigative reporters, and I guess I should disclose, I know Doug, he's a friend of mine, but they're, you know, as soon as these stories come out, right, everybody's getting their news from Twitter, there's all kinds of rumors swirling around, and some of the important work is debunking what's going on out there, and some blog had said that, oh, Freddie Gray had a spinal surgery a week before this happened because he was in a car accident. And look, I looked at the court records, and he got a settlement. And this was kind of 21st century journalism. These are investigative reporters who spend, you know, months on stuff. Mark and Doug just real quick turned around a piece called "The Truth About Freddie Gray's Pre-Existing Injury from Car Accident," and just debunked it. They went to court and actually got the court records, talked to the lawyers,
and
lead paint lawsuit.
Oh, there we are. Okay, we lost you there for a second, Lawrence. You said that they debunked the piece and went to court, talked to the lawyers, and what was the conclusion?
There was no car accident. There was no spinal surgery. The settlement that they discovered online in the case search was actually a settlement from a lead paint lawsuit. That Freddie Gray grew up in a part of Baltimore where there's just tons of lead paint, and he had ridiculous levels. Like, I just had kids recently, and they're like, don't let your kid get over 5 for lead paint. And they were like up past 11, 15, 18. And so he got a lead paint settlement. That's what was in the court records. So these investigative reporters that spend so much time and just hit the courthouse, talk to the lawyers, and debunked this thing in real time. Because when you have young black men in cases like this with the police, there's a certain faction that starts caricaturing them, digging up anything they can to make them look like they deserved it. Mm. And I was proud to see my Metro Daily get out there real quick, get their hands on the court records, not just do a quick case search online like these people did, and tell the truth about what's going on here.
That's an excellent example of the difference between real journalism and supposed journalism. We see a lot of supposed journalism in the world these days, which is really more clickbait than anything else. It doesn't tell you too much about the real world around you. So kudos to the Baltimore Sun, which happens to be my own old hometown newspaper as well.
Ah, great.
And we'll put links to those stories here at yourcallradio.org. Now, let's dive further into Baltimore. Those of you who haven't heard the news yet this morning, big developments out of Baltimore. The Maryland State Attorney, Marilyn Mosby, has said that she plans to file criminal charges against 6 officers in the case of Freddie Gray. The death of Freddie Gray has now officially been called a homicide. And you've got the highest law enforcement officer in the state of Maryland saying that she has probable cause to bring criminal charges. The 6 officers, not clear yet whether those officers have been arrested. Lawrence, can you bring us up to date on anything beyond that of what I've already said? And also, tell us a little bit about Marilyn Mosby, the Maryland State Attorney General. What do we know about her?
Well, first it's important to know who was state's attorney before her, a guy named Greg Bernstein, who ousted another female black state's attorney in a campaign where his tagline was "Fight Crime First."
So Marilyn Mosby is African American.
She is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you had this sort of perception that Bernstein was trying to get out there, that Jessamy was soft on crime, and he got in there. But then Mosby got in there and ousted him. Her husband is the city council person for the 7th District here in Baltimore. And he was sort of, there's an election about 5 years ago that brought a little fresh young blood into the city council. Nick, who's, I don't know, all I know is he's younger than me, and another real young guy, Brandon Scott, came in to the city council. Nick just came in a couple of years ago, and Marilyn just got in last year, so she's new. All eyes were on her this morning, and she just read the charging statement, like telling a story. From the first stop to the Western District. And she thanked the police and saying, you know, they're not all bad, and thank you for preserving order. Thank you to the peaceful marchers. Even thank you to our new Republican governor for hustling the autopsy results to her.
That's Governor Hogan.
Governor Hogan, and she—I don't know—it was a real savvy press conference. She just kept stating the facts of what happened, the charges, and then she said, "You know, I've heard you saying no justice, no peace," and basically she was saying, "Here's the justice, please give us back some peace."
And the initial news coverage indicates that, at least on the streets, that there's a lot of people who are indeed grateful for this statement by the Maryland Attorney General. Is that your sense of it being there?
Well, there's a lot of honking, and I was at Home Depot this morning and broke the news to the guy at the counter, and he just looked at me like, "What?" You know, people are they're not jubilant. They're saying, you know, this is a step. They're saying this is a step. But people are it's just a very quick change of mood. I haven't been down to Pennsylvania North today, so I can't say for sure. I've just been listening to the radio.
Okay. And then one more question on that. There's been reports that essentially that Mr. Gray, inside the police van, struck his neck on a bolt, B-O-L-T, a bolt inside the van, and that is what severed 70% of his spine and crushed his voice box, and that this presumably could have happened during the so-called rough ride that the police sometimes allegedly give to suspects. Did the Attorney General address that issue
specifically? She didn't talk about the bolt. The bolt, what I had read, was that there was essentially an injury on his head, the same shape as a bolt on the back of the thing. I didn't hear her talk about that, but when she just listed what happened to each of these stops, what happened was, you know, he's got handcuffs on, and then they put leg cuffs on, and they never strap him in. They never put the seatbelt on, and at one point, he's on his stomach on the floor of this van, and, you know, they go to check on him a couple of times, and he's asking for help, and he's responsive. Then the police say, "Hey, we need you to bring the wagon up to, you know, North Avenue. We arrested somebody else." And when they get there, he's unresponsive. And it's still sort of left to us to piece together exactly what happened. But she didn't, you know, she didn't say that his head hit the bolt or anything. But it's clear that he was responsive when he went in and he was not when he came out. And that, you know, if whether it was a rough ride, a nickel ride or not, the guy's hands are cuffed, his legs are cuffed. If you are falling off of that bench, what are you going to put out to stop yourself?
That's Lawrence Lanahan speaking to us from Baltimore this morning on Your Call Radio. I'm going to bring in Tim Shorrock in a minute, but I also want to bring in you, the listeners here. Give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. The numbers are 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. One more time, 866-798-8255, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Tim Shorrock, you've also done some reporting in Baltimore over the years, and just wonder if we could broaden the conversation out a little bit here. As you've looked at the national and media coverage of the Freddie Gray turbulence, what's your take on it in terms of how this has been conveyed to the American people as a whole?
Well, I've been watching mostly, you know, CNN and MSNBC and the networks, and it's just been kind of astonishing, really, to see people like Wolf Blitzer, you know, kind of get in there and sort of lecture these people in the streets, particularly Wolf Blitzer of CNN. You know, he acts like this sort of national moralizer or something, you know, setting these people straight. He always asks the activists in the streets, you know, "You don't approve of violence, do you?" Like a question he would never ask people in power, right? These are the people in the streets angry over what's happened in their community and the police violence and the racist police violence that's been happening all over the country. And here he is lecturing them and sort of leading these questions, like that kind of leading question. But what I've really enjoyed is watching people that they're interviewing push back. I mean, there's this one activist who's been there who's really done a great job of just questioning the whole precepts of these media people and what they're about. And there's been some moments that have just been brilliant that I've seen where, you know, people have really been very explicit about how terrible the coverage of the media is. And I think it's really sort of like a surprise to the news broadcasters, because they just think everyone's so cowed by them, but people are not. And other than that, I think that, you know, when I've covered Baltimore in the past, you know, it's always amazed me the economic disparities in this city. About 10 years ago, I was doing some research and investigating of Johns Hopkins Hospital, which, you know, as we all know, is like, you know, always ranks number one. And it's very, you know, Johns Hopkins is a very powerful institution in Baltimore. And, you know, I was kind of surprised when I started, you know, looking at their, you know, board of directors and, you know, who all these powerful people from corporate financial worlds. And also from intelligence, they had a couple people on their board that were, you know, working even actively for the CIA, high-level CIA officials. And here this hospital is in you know, surrounded by one of the, you know, absolutely poorest neighborhoods in the United States, if not the world, in terms of economic disparity. And at the time I was looking at them, the hospital was denying its janitors in the hospital a 10-cent hour raise. You know, there's just this. I mean, I'm sure Lawrence is, you know, he lives there. He knows about this so much, but the disparities mm-hmm. there are so clear, and it's just kind of amazing to see these media people, you know, expressing shock that people would be so angry.
Yeah, we're going to get into that because Lawrence has actually done a year-long investigation of that, the inequality in Baltimore. And let me just mention it before I ask you to tell us a little bit more about that, Lawrence. You know, some amazing facts that I've come up across here, that black people in Baltimore are five times more likely to be arrested for possession of marijuana than whites. Even though the use of marijuana,
that's because white people don't smoke pot.
Right.
I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Right. Even though the races use it about the same amount. And, of course, this has been reported. Over $5.7 million has been paid out by the city of Baltimore, that is the taxpayers, in the last 4 years because of lawsuits. Over 100 police brutality lawsuits.
In dribs
lawsuits.
And drabs. You'd see it in the news here and there, this settlement, that settlement. And then Mark Puente, the same guy I was just talking about, did that investigation for The Sun. And you add up those numbers, and that is a lot of rough.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they were rough rides, but you know what I mean.
It's right.
There are a lot of settlements.
Well, tell us a little bit about, give us a little bit more on your findings about the socioeconomic situation in Baltimore, which is not to say that nobody is saying here that just because people are poor that they are inclined towards criminality or rioting or anything like that. But you have a background of frustration and desperation in Baltimore, don't you?
You do. And I just want to say, I mean, the short version is that there are great disparities on pretty much every health, economic, and social indicator by race in Baltimore. I don't even need to go through which ones. None of them will surprise you. What I think is important to note, what I was partly trying to do with the series, is that if you go into the poorest neighborhood in Baltimore, you know, maybe the poverty rate is 40%. What does that tell you? There's still 60% of people who are not poor, who probably work in paycheck to paycheck, but they're, you know, like Bel Air Edison here in Baltimore, you know, people say, oh, there's murders there. You know, it's been like a 70-80% home ownership rate for a long time.
What does that tell you?
It tells me that there are really, really strong communities, and that it's not the people who tell you what the statistics are that you should be worried about. It's the people who have to live with those statistics. And, you know, this city is just from one neighborhood to the next, you can go from great wealth to great poverty. And what sort of happened during the riot was people had always pretended there was this great distance between those two things, and suddenly it wasn't there anymore. And thing, you know, there were some looting in neighborhoods that don't typically see as much crime as East and West Baltimore. And you can list all the statistics you want, and we did with the series, and we had data maps commissioned. I mean, we literally like drew the landscape of inequality in the city. But this, what happened this week, is how it feels for everybody to confront it. You couldn't ignore it. I mean, the reason I did the series is because it's just, why is the city the way it is? Why do so many people ignore it? And suddenly no one could ignore it. Suddenly, you know, neighborhoods, you know, some of these neighborhoods have been in a state of emergency for decades, and suddenly you had people in other neighborhoods feeling like, oh, can I go outside? Is it safe to go outside? Well, it has been safe to go outside in a lot of places for a long time.
That's Lawrence Lanahan. He's an award-winning journalist from Baltimore joining us to talk about the Freddie Gray situation there. And also from Washington, Tim Shorrock, a national security correspondent with The Nation magazine. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Mark Hertzgard. We'd like you to join the conversation. Here's the number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Just a couple of minutes before we take a break here, Lawrence, can I ask you one more thing? I've read in the Baltimore City paper, which is the weekly paper there in Baltimore, that a number of the protests, the peaceful protests, I should say, in Baltimore this week, have been organized by women. And that this has not really come across in the media coverage, even locally, much less nationally. Does that correspond with what you've seen? And what can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that what happens is people, you know, at least men think of leaders, and they think of men. You know, women are still marginalized at the top of every whatever field you want to talk about. What I've found, I guess I'm not as clued into the gender thing. What I have found is that there are very strong leaders and there's very strong community in a lot of these neighborhoods. And when people want to rally, when people want to help, you see an example of the divide that exists. People who haven't had to live with some of these inequities want to help because there's been this unrest. And they'll start an event. You know, like, oh, we're going to do this, or we're going to rally here, or we're going to do that, without really talking to the leaders that are already in the neighborhoods. And there's a, I did some reporting for Al Jazeera in Sandtown this week, and what I found was that there was a Facebook page saying, hey, let's go to Pennsylvania North at 10 a.m. And 2,000 people said they were going to go on Facebook, but it's like, how are you going to get to Pennsylvania North? It's shut down. And so there is already a group in Sandtown called the No Boundaries Coalition. It was a multiracial, across the economic divide organization of several neighborhoods around there. And they said, hey, why don't you meet at this park? And so by the time I got there, it was this amazing thing where the neighborhood leaders were, you know, a bunch of volunteers would come and they'd go to one neighborhood leader and they'd pass the volunteers onto another neighborhood leader who's talked to the residents who said, we need help here. And the neighborhood was actually in charge. And it really felt like the way it needed to be. So I think it's just indicative of even the most well-meaning people in this city are so disconnected from the neighborhoods, you know, where they think they can just, you know, show up and help, that even the most well-meaning people are sort of talking past each other a little bit. But it's really beautiful when everybody comes together and listens to the leaders who are already there.
That's Lawrence Lanahan speaking to us from Baltimore. He's a radio journalist and has done a long series on inequality and disparities in the socioeconomic level in Baltimore. We'll have links to that here at Your Call Radio. And you are listening to Your Call. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar. And this is our weekly media roundtable where we speak to journalists about coverage of the news from Baltimore. It's been Lawrence Lanahan from the station WYPR. And from Washington, and we'll be talking about Japan later, we're joined by veteran journalist Tim Shorrock of The Nation magazine, who's also the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. We've got a couple of calls. We'll get to those right after this short break. You're listening to Your Call on KALW.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call. You can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org, or give us a call. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Inflection Point, following that at 12 noon, this week's edition of the Tavis Smiley Show. And at 1 o'clock today, it's Latino USA here on local public radio, KALW.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org, where you can also listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. For example, on Monday, we continue our series on the water crisis in California, focusing on the big, powerful players in California's water system and how they determine who gets water, what is paid for it, who gets left out. That's Monday with Rose Aguilar on Your Call here on KALW. Today, though, it's our Friday Media Roundtable where we talk to journalists who are covering the week's news, also about the coverage of the week's news. And this week we're talking about Baltimore and Japan. We've been talking about the mass protests in Baltimore following the death of Freddie Gray, who died while in police custody. And we're also talking about Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's visit to the United States and the discussions around the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and a new military alliance. If you have a show idea for us, please let us know. Drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can call us 866-798-8255. What do you think about the media coverage of the protests in Baltimore? And do you see any shift in the issues the media has been focusing on over the course of the week? What do you want the media to focus on? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. So we're going to go to a caller now. I believe we have Eric in San Mateo.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Hey.
Always a pleasure to listen to you. I have a question to your guest. It seems surprising that none of the media has been covering the arrest record of the gentleman, Eric Gray. As a voting Democrat, I understand it's ugly to be detained by the police and be found dead, but at the same time, the person is a heroin drug dealer, arrested more than 20 times. Somebody should have stepped up and said, look, it's just one person. It's just a criminal. It's a mishandling. It's not worth the rights. It's not worth the closing the stadium and so on and so forth. And yet we don't see it at all. Even Fox News did drop the ball on that and did not report the arrest record. But
thanks for that question, Eric. Lawrence, can you speak to that? Freddie Gray's past, does he have an arrest record, and what's the story there?
He does. I don't know. Do we disclose every single arrest for anybody who's ever in the news? Whose records are we looking up? Yeah, he's got some charges for distribution. If you go to these neighborhoods,
does he have convictions or only arrests?
I can't remember. It's a long enough list. It could be some of both. But if you go to some of these neighborhoods, you try to find, you know, a young person without charges. The police are there constantly. Somebody's buying those drugs, and there are very few economic opportunities there. And guess what? Once you get something on your record, then you get out and try to get another job with those charges on your record. They did have something here in Baltimore where they banned the box. So if you wanted a city job, it used to be a box where you'd click off and say, you know, whether you've had convicted of a criminal offense or not. Now that's off, so you can at least get to the interview stage and get a job. There's a cycle of economic devastation in these neighborhoods where the criminal justice system, the workforce, housing, schools, health all come into play. And yeah, some young people feel that they have no option but to go out onto the corner to make money. But I'm not sure that, I mean, when someone is, let's say this plays out that this was an unjust killing or death at the hands of the police. Let's say that's what they decide. Should every time that happens, should we, you know, flip through the rap sheet of the person? Where do we draw the line where they deserved it or not?
Deserved it or not is a harsh phrase, I think. I just came back from New Orleans, where the police department is notorious for having arrested many, many people and not necessarily with crimes actually having been committed. And yet, at the same time, it would seem that's a fairly relevant fact at some point to mention that there is a police record for somebody. Let's move on to the next caller here. I think it's Gilbert in Oh, I'm sorry. We lost Gilbert. Here's another question, though. What is the, this is coming in off of email, what is the right word that should be used to describe what's been going on in Baltimore this week? Some people object to the use of the word riots. Other people talk about unrest being not a strong enough word. Let's hear both of you on that. Tim, why don't you start?
Well, I think it's, I think the proper word is uprising. I mean, there's nothing else I could think of to describe it. I mean, you know, in situations where, you know, people just can't take anymore and have had enough, that's often what happens. You know, getting back to Asia, you know, I've done a lot of reporting over the years on a military coup in South Korea that the U.S., you know, helped. You know, was a key actor behind, and you know, there was a city where the people rose up against the military, and you know, the government called it a riot for years, so the Gwangju riot. It was an uprising. It was people in the streets, all kinds of people who just could not take this kind of killing anymore by the hands of their military, and it's an uprising. People rise up, and people demand justice, and they have nothing to lose. You know, because things have been so bad. I think you know, riot just doesn't do it. I think what, you know, everything that I've seen and read of what's been going on in the streets of Baltimore, that's what it is.
How about you, Lawrence?
I don't know.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I don't know what it gets us to all agree on the word. I think the less we agree on the word for it, the more we talk about what's actually happening. There's been a lot of protesting. There's been some assaults on police. There's been looting. There's been vandalism. There has been demands for justice. There's a lot going on, and different things are happening in different pockets of the city. I think if you compare it to the 68 riots, it doesn't feel a whole lot like a riot. Just the numbers of arrests and, you know, people being injured and dying and fires and all that. It was real chaotic Monday night. It was. And a lot of things are happening. But I'm not sure, you know, uprising, yeah, that's what some people are doing. Some people are just out for some fun. And some people are just out for justice. So
well, speaking of the protest, do we have any solid numbers about how many people have been protesting out in the streets in these peaceful marches? Is it 500? Is it 5,000? Is it 50,000?
I don't think it's 50,000. I mean, there's only 620,000 people in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the numbers, but I would say some of them have been in the hundreds, maybe some a couple thousand. But I don't want to sign off on any numbers.
Okay, and we've got another caller, Gabriella in San Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. You know, you speak so nonchalantly about the violence that is happening in Baltimore, and it's a little bit concerning to me, the double standard that we're creating, that somehow because this youth is disenfranchised and because they're angry, that it's okay for them to express that anger through looting and violence. And the other double standard that exists is with Toya Graham, who is Mother of the Year for beating up her child, which under other circumstances, if it was a different race, if it was different sexes involved, that would not be okay. And then another interesting double standard that we're seeing is this demand for justice and justice without due process, and this demand that, you know, why haven't, up until today, why hadn't the officers been charged? And people kind of demanding justice without the due process and without the research and without all of the information gathering. And that's the same due process that they're demanding for all of these people that have been jailed in Baltimore and not charged with anything. And, you know, I've read stories where there were people that were in jail for, you know, for 48 hours without food, without their medication. And it's just really interesting, just the double standards that we're creating in the dialogue about what's happening.
Thank you for those sharp questions, Gabriella. Double standard. Let's take those three questions in order here. Tim, what about that? Is too nonchalant talking about the violence there? Are we excusing violence on the part of people just because they've been oppressed?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, I think Lawrence is right. I mean, you know, he's been there for one thing. I mean, yeah, you know, lots of times, you know, kids come out and they get, I mean, we've seen this in New Orleans. I mean, you know, people, you know, just, you know, they take advantage of a situation to, you know, commit violence or commit other kinds of crimes. There's law, you know, there's just the police are there, but, you know, it's sort of this loose situation, and you know, people do all kinds of things, but it's not to justify that. It's just that they're, you know, the vast majority of people out there in the streets are not doing that, and the vast majority of people want to have due process. That's the whole issue for them, is that there's such a contrast between how black people and black men are treated by police around the country in contrast to everybody else. And, you know, I think here, when people, went to the barricades in Ferguson over the last summer, it was because there wasn't this kind of due process. I mean, there you had a DA who was close to the police, and they decided, you know, not to charge anybody. And so, you know, here you have a case where they looked at it, and these six police will be put on trial. So that means they're going to get their day in court. They may be found, or some of them may be found not guilty. Some of them may be found guilty. That's due process. I see the double standard more in the media, just looking at it like, you know, just a bunch of people spouting off and, you know, throwing rocks out of, you know, just because this word has been used a few times, thugs. I think that's a double standard. I mean, you know, they don't say that about when it's people in a country that the U.S. supports militarily. When people are rising up, it's always like, oh, look at these brave people in the streets. That's what you'll get from CNN and the networks. You know, look at these brave people in Egypt standing up. But, you know, when it's here in their own country, they have a hard time facing the fact that, you know, we have such disparities, and we have such poverty and inequality.
We have another call now. Hold on just a second, guys. We have another call from Joan in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm just calling about the coverage in terms of, A, comparisons with 1968, because I'm old enough to remember that. And it's just misleading, because when you watch it on television, it looks as though Baltimore is burning from end to end. And I have friends in Baltimore, and so I called them. And they were undisturbed. I've been informed, you know, from somebody who lives there, that it's in one specific area. Now, Baltimore is a huge black population, so we can't say the black area. It's a poor area, probably the worst part of Baltimore in terms of socioeconomic. But the action is restricted, it seems to me, from what I can gather, to that area. But when I called my friend, she said people are walking their children outside, they're going to the store, it's normal day. And the TV coverage is very, very misleading. And even the New York Times had it on the front page the other day. And that's when I thought, wow, this is really widespread. But even that story didn't clarify the geographical location.
Thanks. That's Joan in San Francisco. Lawrence, is that your impression being there in Baltimore?
Well, actually, I mean, I'm about, you know, 5 miles away from North and Pennsylvania, and somebody smashed out the windows at both of the stores at the end of my street. So there was widespread vandalism, at least. I think part of that is all the law enforcement was kind of drawn to one part of the city. And, you know, the store at the end of my street has a big sign that says Diamonds. So if you know the cops are 5 miles away, you know, crime's 99% of the time about opportunity. But to get back to that earlier comment about the double standard on violence and rushed, you know, calls for justice, I mean, there ought to be justice for the people who did that, right, to the stores at the end of my street. I don't know who's excusing the violence. Violence is not okay. as far as the rushing to justice, I don't think the protests are about let's charge these police overnight. I think it was more about, given everything that's happened before, we're afraid that you're not ever going to. It was a more generalized anger and a more generalized call for justice. So, you know, I don't think you pillory these cops, you know, the night after it happens. But I don't think that's totally what it was about.
Well, and that's what makes today's news so important. Those of you who are just tuning in now, let me repeat it. The Attorney General of Maryland, Marilyn Mosby, has announced that she has, quote, probable cause to bring criminal charges against the six officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody. And that death has now been officially ruled a homicide and his arrest ruled illegal. On top of that, the charges range from second-degree murder to assault, and protesters who were standing there cheered as the Attorney General made that announcement. So we're now going to shift in the final minutes of the show. We've been talking mainly about Baltimore so far. We're going to talk about Japan now and Prime Minister Abe's visit to Washington this week. But let me just first invite everyone one more time to, if you'd like to join the conversation, it's the phone number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Joining us have been Lawrence Lanahan. He's a former senior producer at the Baltimore NPR station WYPR, where he launched The Lines Between Us, a year-long examination of regional inequality that won the DuPont Award. And from Washington, Japan expert Tim Shorrock. He is a national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and also the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. So let's talk about Japan for a second, and I'm going to focus mainly on you here, Tim. It strikes me that in some ways, the way the American media treats Japan, it reminds me a little bit of Canada, which maybe sound odd, but it's one of those countries that we don't, I think, pay as much attention to. We kind of take it for granted. Oh, they're friends of the United States, and we don't really pay as much attention to them. But they are a hugely important country, certainly on the economic front. And when Prime Minister Abe came to Washington this week, one of the big things that was on the plate between him and President Obama was this new trade deal that they are trying to bring about, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Did, aside from the merits of the partnership, was there any progress made on that front this week?
No, and actually there was very little because Japan, various economic interests, especially in agriculture, are very loath to allow mass import of certain kinds of agricultural goods under any free trade agreement. But really the real purpose of Abe being here was to solidify this U.S. military relationship, which has deepened under Obama to an extent it's never been before. And this is what's missing from all the coverage in the United States. There's nothing, no mention that this government, this Liberal Democratic Party government, which has basically been in power since the 1950s
in Japan,
is the most right-wing pro-militarist government ever in Japan. This Abe comes from a long line of prime ministers, government officials. His grandfather was a man named Nobusuke Kishi, who was a Class A war criminal during World War II, but was let out of the prisons by the U.S. occupation during the Cold War because he was seen as an ally against communism, and he became the prime minister. He actually ran Japan's operations in Manchuria, and as we know, you know, Japan did horrible things in China and Korea and lots of other parts of Asia. Abe came here, and the big story was, you know, what's he going to say about World War II? Well, what he said was, you know, he regretted what Japan did, and Japan caused suffering. Well, you know,
yes, and of course, people were nice pressuring him to apologize,
which is what Japan did in World War II.
Yeah.
And this went over very well with Obama and Vice President Biden and, you know, Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy, because they've got Japan now, you know, rearming like it's never done before. you know, lifting bans on its constitution to expand U.S.-Japanese military to allow them to be, you know, operate overseas in alliance with the United States. And this is something that, you know, U.S. governments have been pushing on Japan for decades. And they finally reached it under Obama. And to me, it's just amazing how little coverage this got. I mean, even the New York Times lead story was all about TPP. And, you know, that it really, if you go behind here, this military alliance is what it's all about. I mean, it's a major alliance. I mean, this is Japan, you know, has one of the largest militaries in the world. And, of course, it combines the U.S. military might with Japan's high technology.
And this has been a concern, obviously, to China as well.
There's a lot of people in Japan. In fact, a poll came out yesterday. The majority of Japanese are against this kind of, you know, lifting the controls so Japan can now take part in military operations overseas. They do not want this. Their constitution is the only constitution in the world of a major country where it pledges it, you know, not to make war. And, you know, a lot of people want to keep that, even though it was imposed on them by the United States. They believe in it. They like the peace constitution. And
United States and Japan has.
When I look at the U.S.
Tim, can you hear me?
To me, it's a little shocking how little coverage.
Tim, can you hear me? Tim, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I've tried to interrupt you a couple times, and I can't tell if you're able to hear me or not.
Oh, I didn't hear you before. I'm sorry.
Okay. Let's touch briefly again there on the emotional issue here of the sex slaves, which, of course, is very important to the people who were protesting in Washington this week and pressing the Prime Minister of Japan to apologize formally about this. And, of course, as you mentioned, he comes from a very right-wing tradition there where he's even gone to the shrines to talk about the war criminals in Japan. And how did Prime Minister Abe this week finesse that call for apologies? Because he didn't actually apologize, did he?
He did not. And when it came to these so-called comfort women, he said nothing. And even though Representative Honda in Congress, you know, did bring a Korean comfort woman to the speech, she was there, sitting there, sort of in his face a little bit. The Japanese American in Congress were not happy with this. And I have to say that, you know, if you look at the coverage of this in Asian papers, the South Korean government was not impressed at all with Abe's remarks. Chinese. They just refused to deal with this fact that they kidnapped, you know, thousands of women, not only from Korea. Many were from the Philippines. Many were from China. And actually, I learned when I was in South Korea visiting the Comfort Women Museum that some were actually from Australia that were, you know, forced into sexual slavery for Japanese soldiers all over the Pacific area. And they just sort of act like it's, you know, they were just sort of prostitutes and they were doing it willingly, and they never have come to grips with this. And this is what really angers people in Asia.
And what about in Japan itself, Tim? Does Prime Minister Abe's position on this, and indeed the military alliance as a whole, how is that playing politically? Is that working for him politically in Japan?
Well, the LDP has been reelected. I think here is where the U.S. bases in Okinawa come in. Because, you know, most of the U.S. military bases in Japan are concentrated on the southern island of Okinawa. And this is where the big forward base is for the U.S. Marines, for example, that's in big dispute now about, you know, where to move it. And so a lot of Japanese are, you know, it's sort of like, you know, not in their backyard, so it becomes less of an issue. And the LDP, you know, is in power. They've been reelected a couple times in recent years. But in Okinawa, the governor, the entire parliamentary delegation, and mayors of the principal cities are all united in wanting the U.S. Marine base out.
So will that go out under this new military partnership? What's that?
It's going to stay, and it's going to be expanded.
So that's likely to cause some pretty difficult politics for Abe, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I think that, you know, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for the United States too. I mean, I firmly believe that the United States, they did negotiate a deal with Japan to reduce the so-called footprint of the Marines in Okinawa, but part of the deal is to move the main group of them to this other site in the northern part of Okinawa, and that's where it sits now. And I think the United States should renegotiate that, get those Marines out of there. They don't have to be in Okinawa. They can be in Guam. They could be in California. They don't need to be there at all. And I think that's what should be done, because it's clear that this is going against the democratic wishes of the people of Okinawa. I mean, 70 years of American occupation is enough. And I think there it's fair to call it an occupation, because those bases take up a huge amount of land, and they're right in the middle of a very, very crowded city, planes screaming overhead, you know, elementary schools and colleges, and it's a very volatile situation.
So, Tim, we're about to come to the end here. Have you written anything about the military partnership that we can post here on the website?
Actually, I have, but it's a little bit dated. I've been focusing more on Korea lately, because I've written a lot about that, and I'm also going to Korea in a couple of weeks. I will be there. But if people go to my site on The Nation, you can see. I will be doing a piece on this shortly.
Okay, so come to the Nation magazine site, thenation.com, and you will see Tim Shorrock's upcoming piece on the implications of the U.S.-Japan military alliance, which is being left out of most of the coverage of Prime Minister Abe's visit to Washington. And Lawrence, can you tell us quickly, is there anything that you're working on at the moment?
I am recovering from putting two big pieces together in 2 days in Sandtown for Al Jazeera, so I'm just looking forward from here on out. But thanks for having me on, and thanks to WEAA for hosting me here.
Very good, and we will, of course, be linking to those pieces here at KALW. We want to thank all of you who've been calling in as well. We've been speaking today with Tim Shorrock of The Nation magazine and Baltimore radio journalist Lawrence Lanahan. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks for the emails and phone calls. I'm very sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Who are California's water power brokers? On the next Your Call, we kick off a week-long series on California's water crisis by discussing the forces who control access to water here in California. The state's record drought has resulted in the first ever statewide water restriction. So how's the allocation of water determined? And who controls the flow and the price? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.